Well, we do have quite a number of visitors this morning, and we'll let you know where we've been. We have been studying the book of Hebrews, and we've reached chapter 11, which is commonly known as the faith chapter. And today, we'll take a look again at the first seven verses of Hebrews chapter 11. Faith is a word worthy of careful handling. We've got a chapter called the faith chapter. It begins with the words, now faith is a word worthy of careful handling. And the word believe is likewise worthy of a thoughtful definition and careful definition. Faith and believing, they're used in conversation all the time, used in print, used in the media. But it's true that the definition is not always precise with regard to what's meant. And it can differ with regard to who's saying it and what they're thinking, the mindset in their saying it. What do we mean? In that all-important issue, since it says salvation is by faith and those kinds of things, what do we mean when we speak of faith and of believing? And in fact, wouldn't it be true that quite commonly, very pervasively in public conversation, in our lives, our situation and culture, that the idea of faith, the idea of believing, is made subjective, a matter of the private world, the private mind and autonomy of the individual. And it's all about the pronouns. You know, it's your faith or his faith or her faith or my faith or their faith. As though the important thing were not what or whom is believed, but the important thing being the individual who believes it, his thoughts, his right to think them. I think that's common in our whole sort of societal situation. But that mindset, by way of definition of faith, is very opposite from what is conveyed to us about faith in the Bible and what's conveyed to us in Hebrews chapter 11. Because in the Bible, the object of faith is the important thing. Who and what faith trusts? Is it true? And that's the important thing in the Scriptures. And the Bible's object of faith is the one living and true God. His character, His justice, His power, His authority, His graces and kindnesses and promises, and His reliability. It's very specific to that. So when Hebrews 11 begins with the words, now faith is being sure of what we hope for, that's not a general broad brushstroke. The author is not defining faith in terms of just any idea or all ideas or any particular possible religious conviction. Faith, in fact, is not being sure of what you hope for, no matter what you hope for. Does that make sense? Faith is not being sure of what you hope for, no matter what you hope for, not in the book of Hebrews. The hope that's mentioned here is an objective prospect that God has made known through sending His Son, Jesus. It's the whole tenor of everything that leads up to chapter 11, which says faith is being sure of what we hope for. There's 148 paragraphs leading up to this phrase, faith is being sure of what we hope for. And faith then has been defined. It's been defined well and very specifically. You see, according to Hebrews, God has spoken to us by His Son, Jesus Christ. God's Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of His being. How shall we escape if we ignore such a great salvation announced by the Lord? That's the whole tenor of this book. Christ has appeared once for all to do away with sin by the sacrifice of Himself. When Christ came into the world, He said, "Here I am. It is written of me in the scroll. I have come to do your will, O God." And by that will, we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. Therefore, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith. That's what leads up. That's just a little summary of some things been said so far in this book. That's what leads up to the words. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. We can know what it is that we are to hold on to, confident, believing. That's been very well defined for us in Hebrews. I said last week that Hebrews 11 seems to highlight four things concerning the faith of those examples that he will give. He gives quite a number of examples. And in those examples, after this brief opening definition, it seems to highlight four things. Number one, that it is faith by which one is counted righteous. Number two, that faith brings about obedience in God's people. Number three, that it is through faith that people gain what God has promised. You see, God's made promises. His people gain those through faith. And number four, faith is the cause for courage and perseverance. So we have four categories. I won't do all four of those today. As a matter of fact, just number one. But we have righteousness, obedience, gaining what was promised, and courage and perseverance in it. So let's read the first seven verses of Hebrews 11, and we're going to talk about that first category, righteousness. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. By faith, we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice than Cain did. By faith, he was commended as a righteous man when God spoke well of his offerings. By faith, he still speaks, even though he is dead. By faith, Enoch was taken from this life so that he did not experience death. He could not be found because God had taken him away. For before he was taken, he was commended as one who pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. By his faith, he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. I notice in that this whole chapter 11, seems to come in sections. Verses 1 to 7 constitute a section like that. And I notice a repeated word. Did you, by the way? We're just reading through it real quickly. Any repeated words in the first seven verses? One of them is the word commended. And in fact, you'll see that three times, but there's a fourth time where it's the same original words translated differently, translated spoke well of. So it says the ancients were commended in what? In faith. Abel was commended as a righteous man. God spoke well of or commended his offering. Enoch was commended as one who pleased God. All of those are translations of the same original word. And I think in studying this passage, the precise meaning of that word helps us know with understanding what the point is. So we'll spend a little bit of time on that. What is that word? I won't pronounce the Greek word, I'll probably mess it up. But the word translated commended or spoke well of That word, to give you the clearest meaning, the clearest sense of it, I'm going to use the words a testimony of approval. I mean, it's a verb, obviously, but for one to testify approval of something. It's one thing to say, good job. It's another thing to say, you are approved. And I think this particular word leans in that direction fairly in a focused way. I'm going to give you another example of the use of the same words in another passage. I think it's helpful. 3 John 1:12 uses the word a couple of times. And it's used about a fellow by the name of Demetrius. The English Standard Version brings out exactly what I'm getting at. And the Apostle John, in 3 John, wanted the people to whom he was writing to know that Demetrius was approved. He wanted them to know that you could trust this one and whatever. And it says, 3 John 1:12, Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. We also add our testimony. And you know that our testimony is true. How does they try to get that across to them? It's with the word that I'm talking about. This word commended or this word spoke well of is used there. In Demetrius' case, he had received a testimony of approval from a number of sources. But everybody he's dealt with testifies that he is on the right track and whatever. The truth itself testifies to Demetrius. We, and that includes the Apostle John, say, I add to that my testimony. And it's this word testimony, or the idea of testifying. There's another way I could put it. The particular word I'm talking about would be something like what I'd mean if I could vouch for someone in their character or quality, to testify concerning someone in their character or quality. This may seem silly, but you hand me a list of orthodontists. You know, you say, Tim, you know anything about these orthodontists? And do you know anything about Drs. Asbury or Duke or Kilmer or Nalchajian or Sheldon or Snyder? And I respond, well, I haven't any experience with any of those except one. And him I can vouch for. You see, that's the kind of word that seems to be used here. So now, let me apply what I've just said to the meaning of Hebrews 11, 1 and 2. Faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. This is what the ancients were commended for. When it says this is what the ancients were commended for, I think there's more in there than to simply say folks have thought well about these old Bible characters on this count. It's more than that. In fact, very precisely, it is that by faith, these named ones, Abel and Enoch, Noah, and Abraham and all the rest, because it's an introductory thing to this whole section, these people of God from the Old Testament, by faith, they received God's testimony of approval. Faith is the fundamental means by which one is declared approved by God. And of course, in this first section, the issue is righteousness. Are they righteous or are they not righteous? These were declared to be righteous. It said straightforwardly about Abel and about Noah. Abel was declared, received this testimony of righteousness. And Noah was an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. About Enoch, it's said a little bit indirectly, but it was this testimony that he pleased God. It's the same basic and fundamental issue. Let's look at each of those characters, Abel and Enoch and Noah. The Genesis account, we happen to be in chapter 4, if you want to look at that, I'm just reading a few verses though. The Genesis account in chapter 4 said that when Eve gave birth to Cain, she said, with the help of the Lord I brought forth a man. Later she gave birth to Abel. Now, Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flocks. The Lord looked with favor upon Abel and his offering. But on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. Has that passage ever confused you when you read it? You know, oh, is that fair? It's just two different, you know, lines of work. You know, why the... And we probably wrestle and we try to exegete and think, what might it be? And we go on, you know, in depth wondering, what might it be? And I think the thing that sneaks into our guts is, was that arbitrary? I want to say three things about that, to say that we can affirm that it's not arbitrary, and then explore some of these things. We will never know exactly what was unacceptable about the unacceptable offering of Cain. It might have been that because his heart wasn't in it, he brought some mediocre stuff, a basket full of clippings. You know, I don't know you want to put it that way. But in one sense, we don't have to go there. We don't have to get to all the detail of what it might have been. The only other possibility I can think of is that it was clear to both of them that it should be blood sacrifice, and he refused it. Those are possibilities, but it's not stated here what it is. I'll tell you what is stated in two places in that whole account. He was told it wasn't right. What you did wasn't right. And in another place in Scripture, he is called evil well before he kills Abel. Okay? Before he killed Abel, you see, he's given the offering. It was not accepted. He goes off and he's angry. But the Lord speaks to him before he kills Abel and says, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what's right, will you not be accepted?" Implication? He didn't do what was right. If you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you. And of course, in Cain's case, it did have him when he took his brother's life. There's another very significant evaluation of Cain, 1 John 3:12. Now we know that the action of killing Abel is wickedness. This reflects on a wicked cause for that action. 1 John 3:12 instructs us not to be like Cain. Do not be like Cain, who belonged to the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because, and here's the issue, because his own actions were evil and his brother's were righteous. Again, this reflects on actions and prior to the murdering of Abel. His were evil, Abel's were righteous. But then now consider something. Why is Abel's offering acceptable? It's a better offering, right? By faith, Abel offered God a better sacrifice. The question is, what makes that acceptable? What is better about it? One thing I can say that doesn't seem to be the issue of comparison is just that it was higher quality stuff. I mean, it may have been higher quality stuff. It's fat portions, so it's good quality portions from his flock, and it may have been better in quality than Cain's basket of clippings. Again, we don't have to go there. But think of it this way. A man's offering to God cannot win God's favor by amount or expense. Psalm 50 would absolutely cancel that possibility. God says, "I have no need of a bull from your stall or goats from your pens. For every animal in the forest is mine, and the cattle in the thousand hills. I know every bird in the mountains. And the creatures of the field are mine. If I were hungry, I wouldn't tell you. For the world is mine and all that's in it." What makes Abel's sacrifice better? High quality meat? Not in essence. What do we know for sure about Abel's offering and its acceptability? We know that the offering was by faith. And that was that by which it was accepted. It was because Abel believed God and trusted God that his offering was of the right kind. And again, that's pretty much all we know. Here's the interesting thing. Abel himself was accepted. He was declared a righteous man. His offering was accepted. He was accepted, declared righteous. He was attested. He was commended as a righteous man. And I think in this we learn what really honors God. This is what made an offering receive God's approval. It was trust. I'm going to say a little more about that, but let's go on to Enoch. What do we know about Enoch? Just a couple of verses about his life. We do know, I think, however, that things were bad around him in his era. You want to talk about the ancients? Enoch is very ancient. He was only 7 generations away from Adam. But the New Testament book of Jude counts him a prophet and actually quotes a prophecy from Enoch, 7th from Adam. But what is that prophecy? He says this, see, Enoch says, Enoch, this man says, see, the Lord is coming with thousands upon thousands of his holy ones to judge everyone and to convict all the ungodly of all the ungodly acts that they have done in the ungodly way and of all the harsh words ungodly sinners have spoken against him. I presume then that he speaks to people in his own culture as a prophet, which were ungodly in that. What else do we know about Enoch? That God did spare him from death. What a unique thing. There's only one other, there's only one other that is spared from death in this way. I think a powerful testimony to his world that there is hope of life after death. Because the world by then would have been familiar with the curse of death for sin. There's some longevity going on, but people are still dying. This is about 1,000 years into the history of mankind almost, and many had died. Adam was dead by this time. Seth might not have been dead by this time. Enoch was, 365 years old when he was taken to be with the Lord directly like that. But nonetheless, people are dying, and there was murder in the world, and wickedness, and disease, and old age. Really old age, but death by old age, you see. People were dying. There was death all around. And I asked myself, how much had been revealed to them to make them know that there was life after death? We have so much. What was revealed in Enoch's time, I just don't know, except this, that Enoch walked with God for 300 years, probably more. It says he walked with God after the birth of Methuselah for 300 years. Hebrews says he believed God. It was testified of him that because of faith he was counted one who pleased God, and God took him. And Enoch did not die. That, I think, is testimony to the world and wonderful revelation of hope to a dying world. So that's just some of the things about Enoch's life. But again, why is Enoch pleasing to God? There's much grace happening in his life to walk with God. That idea, Enoch walked with God. I don't think we're talking about a miracle like walking up through the clouds and up a golden staircase or anything like that. For 300 years, he walked with God, which means in the daily walk of his life, he interacted with God regularly and all the time. Much grace in his life. But was he flawless during those years? Was he a sinless man? And I have to say, biblically, absolutely not. This is a man who walks with God by faith. He is not a sinless man. And all the faithful through all time since Adam had to offer sacrifice. And as Abel comes to God in faith, he offers sacrifice. Sacrifice is a reminder of sin. We know that Noah offered sacrifice. I have no record of Enoch offering sacrifice. But the faithful since Adam offered sacrifice, which reminds them that they are sinners. How is it that this man can be called one who pleases God? By faith, says Hebrews chapter 11. And in fact, this very important point, without faith, it is impossible to please God. You cannot be counted as one who pleases God without it, without believing that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who will seek Him. You cannot receive God's attestation that you are a righteous person without faith. God is pleased not so much by our giving something to Him, I think, but our recognition that we are the receivers. I think it's fascinating that it's put that way. It's impossible to please God without faith because you have to believe that He is a rewarder. He is the giver. And that's good news. Very, very bright news. Let's move on to Noah and conclude here then. Finally, we've got Noah. If times were bad in Enoch's day, they were worse by Noah's day, 600 years later or so. They were worse by Noah's day. Genesis 6 recounts this. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that He'd made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I've created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I've made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. This is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God, it says. But know the nature of Noah's righteousness. Noah was a righteous man, so it says. Yes, but how and why? Because he was a perfect man? No. As a matter of fact, you get to read that just after the Ark incident. You get to read very shortly that he's stone drunk in his tent. So anyway, that's one example. Sometimes we read Noah's story and we think, well, we got at least one situation in which a man found God's favor on the sheer merit of his goodness. But I think we know that it's not that. By the rest of Scripture's testimony, by the fact that Noah was an offerer of sacrifices for sin, recorded sin on his part, all of those reasons. And I thought to myself, if I think of who in all biblical history would be more attuned to the idea of death for sin than Noah. When God approached him and spoke to him and said, I am going to put an end to all people. Death for sin. In holy fear, he built an ark to save his family, believing God, you see. And he's counted a righteous man. Why? Because he believed God and counted him one who rewards those who earnestly seek him. Noah's righteousness is not his own merits, but because he believed God. By the way, it says he condemned the world. I don't think that's some personal vendetta. Ha ha. You know, I have a boat and you don't. You know. I think rather that his faith stood in contrast with the universal wickedness of mankind. By God's choice to feature that difference by salvation. In God's mercy, he saved him. And that Noah rejected all that the world had to offer in favor of all what God had to offer. He believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. That's actually said about Abraham later, but this is the point of Hebrews, these first few examples, Abel and Enoch and Noah. They received testimony that they were righteous, that they pleased God. On what basis? On the basis of trusting Him, believing Him. What should we take home from this? It's actually really, really good news. This is the basis. And that we could participate that. We too, by God's grace, could be counted among those who please Him. Counted among the righteous. God's very own testimony that you are righteous. How? Only by faith. And that faith has been defined for us. All that whole first litany that I gave. God has spoken to us. He's told us of His Son. Jesus came once for all to bear sin. You see, that is the faith. The object of faith has been defined for us. Whatever else anyone, we or anyone might imagine that gains God's favor, we must invest ourselves rather in this, that He is reliable, that He is dependable, that He is bountiful in His giving, that He is bountiful in giving the Lord Jesus Christ. And by this trust, we can find His testimony of approval. Hebrews talks about pleasing God and being counted righteousness, also about being washed, cleansed, all those things, again, by faith.